welcome to the Packet Pushers Priority Queue, the podcast where we get down deep into the guts of a specific data networking topic we're keen on. This show is a continuation of Priority Queue show number 7, where Chris Marget, Tony Matke, Jeff Fry, and me, Ethan Banks, discuss deploying virtual port channel on the Cisco Nexus platform. If you haven't listened to show 7 yet, you'll want to listen to that one first, as this show picks up where that one left off. And so without further pause, off we go.
We've got our symmetrically built VPC infrastructure. We've got a VPC domain at the core, probably a pair of 7Ks. You can do something smaller, possibly, with say 5Ks, but that would be a very small application where you do that. So let's presume you get 7Ks at the core in a VPC domain. Then you've got 5Ks upstream from that in a VPC domain. They're configured up in a full mesh, the double-ended or back-to-back VPC like we were just talking about. Everybody's forwarding between everybody else with no blocking involved as a result of spanning tree. Spanning tree may be there in the background, but he is not causing anybody to block. Okay, now let's talk a little bit more about the traffic flow through this infrastructure, just to kind of focusing on this four-switch topology that I just defined. We talked a bit about HSRP, the router MAC, the HSRP MAC address that is returned to a host that is ARPing for his default gateway could end up, depending on hashing, to either switch in the VPC domain. It could end up at either, let's presume the 7Ks are the ones that hold the IP addresses for the HSRP. They're the ones that are switching between VLANs. Whichever 7K gets it is the one that's going to forward it. So that's kind of a unique traffic flow feature. We talked a bit about peer gateway, and which, Chris, as you said, is kind of the default feature now. Now, there's also peer switch. And Chris, did you want to get into what that deals with for us?
Peer switch is a new thing that introduces some STP convergence enhancements, mostly having to do with, let me back up. When you configure STP on these environments, you're probably going to set a different priority for the one bridge and the other, one of your 7Ks and the other, one of your 5Ks and the other, whatever they are.
Yeah.
And if the lower priority or the root happens to fail, then even though no links are going to block and unblock, spanning tree is going to still reconverge, a new root is going to be elected, and so forth. Peer switch allows the surviving non-root switch to assume the former root's identity. That way, on a failure, nothing spanning tree-wise notices that that happened.
So it's not that a new root election was held or that spanning tree reconverged on who he knew to be the next best root path. He actually assumes the identity of the other one, which implies that the rest of the spanning tree topology doesn't know anything changed.
It's a whole new facet to that whole conspiracy between these guys.
Oh, jeez. Okay.
Yeah, they're synchronizing the bridge IDs for the BPDUs.
Yeah.
Yeah, you need to make sure you have your priority, obviously, configured the same on both.
In something I was talking about earlier, what a lot of people do pre-VDC days, or VPC days, think about a couple of core switches and wanting to do some rudimentary load balancing. You might have your evens all be primary on one and your odd-numbered VLANs primary on another. In a VPC world, you don't really do that. I mean, you don't really have a reason to set up this even odd kind of a scheme like you would have traditionally, because kind of it's all acting as one switch from a standpoint of layer 2 forwarding. So who is primary and who is the backup bridge really doesn't matter anymore.
Well, before this command is entered, it will matter on failure. If the root bridge disappears without peer switch configured, then
yes, you're still going to go through your normal, alternate's going to take over and flip over to the other side. From a standpoint of load balancing traffic through your VPC domain, it is largely irrelevant, would be the point I'm making. But
absolutely.
Yeah.
Funny stuff happens if you lose the root bridge, like, the topology change goes out, and at the edge, MAC address tables age out quickly. This kind of thing stops happening.
To steal a term from Ivan, this is just kind of an extension of the Borg hive mind.
Yeah. So peer switch is someone suggested was a pretty new thing. Did that just come out on a pretty recent version of NXOS?
I didn't mean to imply it was new, because I don't know, but it hasn't been there since the beginning.
Okay. Does anybody know if that's on by default or if that's something you got to turn on?
It's something you have to configure.
Yeah. So we've got there's some other additional features here that when you're dealing with a VPC domain come into play either for optimizing traffic or for keeping the topology stable in the case of a failure. And one of those is called auto recovery. And Tony, did you want to talk about that?
Yeah. When you're bringing up a new VPC domain, before anything will actually establish, you actually have to talk to your remote peer switch via the peer keep alive, via the VPC peer link. Auto recovery is helpful in case you have a power failure or some other incident that causes your switch to reload, and say your remote peer never comes back. Well, all your VPC links are down. Auto recovery will allow those to come up without waiting for that other remote switch.
This is the scenario where you've got you've had a VPC failure, and so like the secondary switch in that VPC domain, he would have shut down his ports that face out to upstream because he's not sure that the topology is stable and so on. So what we're seeing here is auto recovery under certain circumstances would allow those ports on that secondary switch in the domain to come back?
Yes. This is only on when you're actually starting the switch, though. This has to happen in a power failure, you know, or power fail scenario. This won't happen if you're, let's say you disable the VPC on your primary switch, your VPC peer link. The secondary won't go ahead and just bring up its VPC ports because it can't talk to the primary.
Now, this is one of those things where you've got to be sure that the other side is really and truly dead. In other words, there's risk involved in turning on auto recovery. Is it a feature that is turned on by default, or
no? This is an add-on feature. I believe the VPC switch actually waits for three consecutive keep alive failures before actually recovering as well. So there would be a decent delay in bringing the domain back up.
Yeah, I think the auto recovery reload delay can adjust the amount of time that it waits. This is only for power failure scenario. So when they fail, well, when power is lost and they reboot, it can know how long to wait before it becomes active.
Yeah, it all has to do with if I've just booted up and I can't talk to my neighbor, how long should I wait before I give up on him and turn on all the VPCs?
Yep, exactly.
Without this enhancement, the answer was the VPCs never come up.
Which you actually ran into.
My very first deployment, I ran into that situation because of a dead switch.
Now, there's another feature here. I mean, these two switches are unique and have their own control planes and so on, but they do keep some information synchronized between the two of them. One of those things is ARP synchronization. Jeff, did you want to talk about that for a second?
I can give it a shot. It allows for the faster convergence of the routing of the tables, the MAC ARP. Oh, wow. One of them days. Wow, is it one of them days? Too much going on. You know how it goes. You want to take it, Chris? Because my brain just, you know how it works.
So we talked about the peer link being where, you know, traffic is forwarded between switches for, you know, multicast and broadcast always go there. There's extra header and whatnot. Also, the switches will maintain and synchronize various tables. The ARP cache for synchronizing, you know, IP addresses to layer 2 addresses, both switches will always have the same table. Same story for IGMP snooping, because an IGMP host report will only get delivered. It's, you know, it's one frame. It's going to go up one link member in the VPC, so only one switch is going to hear it. Same case with the ARP table. You know, an ARP answer is only going to go up one leg. Only one switch will hear it. But part of their conspiracy, they share this information.
Which seems smart from a standpoint of efficient forwarding. Why have to do that discovery process if someone in your domain has already done that work for you?
Well, right, especially if, you know, the ARP answer is always going to hash to the wrong one, right? We don't know, you know, what sort of link selection algorithm the downstream device is going to use for its aggregate link. So you could ask that ARP question 100 times, and the answer might always go to your neighbor.
Yep.
So they synchronize these sorts of tables.
Now, some more magic here that happens on traffic that's going in between the two switches across the peer link. There is a methodology here, an algorithm that's used to prevent loops, VPC loop prevention algorithm. When a packet crosses the peer link, a bit is set in the header. It causes the packet to be dropped if it attempts to leave the remote switch on a VPC-enabled port or VLAN. And then, and that kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier, you don't do like routed layer 3 links in a VLAN that would be a VPC VLAN. You isolate that to its own, effectively it exists outside the context of the VPC domain. It's kind of a separate thing built more like you would build with traditional switches.
Yeah, there is one exception to that, of course, and that's when you have a VPC failure on one of the switches, which would allow that to leave on the peer switch.
And then one more comment. We kind of touched on it earlier, but I just wanted to bring it back again, which is PAGP, port aggregation protocol, which is Cisco's, I don't know if it's a precursor to LACP, but certainly Cisco had a port aggregation protocol offered as an Ether channel protocol for quite a long time, is not supported with VPC. You've got your two choices again, LACP, which is industry standard 802.3AD, or you've got mode on, which is, trust us, we cabled it right, plug it in and everything's going to be fine. But there's no protocol intelligence there to catch you if you did it wrong and cause some problems there.
Or if an optic fails on you someplace.
Right.
I've been through that pain where the optic failed. Luckily, LACP took it out of the bundle, but I can only imagine.
So, again, we just talked through all this stuff to underscore an important point here. Building a virtual port channel domain with Nexus is not as simple as build a keep alive, build the peer link, you know, assign the two of them to the same domain and off you go. There's more thought that needs to be involved in actually designing this topology. There's differences in how the traffic is forwarded. There's considerations for the traffic that flows between the links. There's consideration for hosts that cannot be dual homed for whatever reasons and circumstances you need to consider to work around that scenario if something breaks in your VPC domain. There's concerns in how to recover from a failure in the VPC domain. It's a big deal. So don't underestimate the value that is going to be afforded you if you take the time to whiteboard this all out, talk through different failure scenarios, and kind of track through device by device on your whiteboard diagram how host A is talking to host B if switch 3 just fell off the map. Those are worthwhile exercises and things to understand. And if you don't know the answer to the question, don't assume, oh, it must do this. I wouldn't do that. I would think it through based on Cisco white papers and best practices and understand exactly what's going on there. VPC domain and the VPC VLANs that you're running have a lot of concerns there for you that are different from what you know from traditional networking, if you will. So, and actually, why don't we jump off of that into a little bit of a discussion about some of the changes to Spanning Tree? You know, the short answer is that yes, you still run Spanning Tree. We already talked about this a little bit earlier in the show. But there's some differences here in running SDP, even though SDP isn't blocking links, right? It's still there, and there's some differences and things to be concerned about. One of those is a feature called bridge assurance. There's a couple of significant points to be made there. Chris, you were talking to us about them. We were planning for the show and kind of got this in detail. You want to give us the lowdown on bridge assurance?
Sure. Bridge assurance is it's a new feature in Spanning Tree, or at least new to those of us familiar with catalysts. And you know, normal Spanning Tree BPDUs are originated by the root switch, and they are repeated with the cost add as they flow through the topology to the edges. On bridge assurance or on Nexus with bridge assurance, the downstream flow of BPDUs is unchanged, but now we have on every bridge assurance enabled link backwards flows of BPDUs from downstream switches towards their one hop upstream. This is a mechanism that allows an upstream switch to figure out if something has gone wrong with the downstream switch. And we didn't have that option before. So now an upstream switch can amputate a downstream switch if it's malfunctioning. So that's a new thing. It's the default interface state on Nexus switches, I'm pretty sure that it eliminates the need for LoopGuard, but don't take my word for it. Think hard. I have, and that's the conclusion I came to.
Yeah, and again, and the ports that this runs across are network-type ports, not edge ports.
Yep, bridge-to-bridge ports.
Yeah.
And so you'll have an interesting experience if you plug a link between a Nexus and a Catalyst, and that is that those links won't work. And if you do, you know, show spanning tree, VLAN, such and such, the report will show that those interfaces as broken, port inconsistent, bridge assurance inconsistent, something along those lines.
Because the Catalyst isn't doing bridge assurance, and so there's not bidirectional BPDU flow across there. He's doing traditional spanning tree. Yeah.
I don't know what's wrong with the SoundStream device, but I never got any BPDUs from him. Catalyst doesn't know how. The fix for that is to do spanning tree port type normal on the interfaces facing old school switches. Alternatively, you can turn it off globally, but you know it's a good thing. I would leave it running. Where you can use it, use it.
Other changes to spanning tree, you've got a type of port called edge, and that is what you would think of as port fast. So port fast, if you're thinking about spanning tree from the old days, if you plug in a host into a port and have spanning tree, all the defaults set for spanning tree, it takes many seconds for that port to go into a forwarding state because that port goes through several stages. He listens and he learns and he determines whether or not it is safe to put that port into a forwarding state based on what he hears on the wire as far as BPDU as he learns the topology. If you have a host plugged into that port, then you know I don't need spanning tree to go through that process on this port. I'm going to override that default behavior and just immediately put them into a forwarding state as soon as the link comes up, and that's spanning tree port fast, which that's probably a pretty normal thing that that you do. In fact, one of the very first things I ever learned as a rookie network engineer, this is going on to almost 15 years ago, I got sent to a site because a host would sometimes, but sometimes not, get a DHCP address. And of course, I go out there troubleshooting the DHCP server thinking this server is flaky, it's got some sort of a problem, or something like that. And long story short, what it turned out was I needed to turn port fast on because it was taking so long for that port to go into forwarding mode that the host would give up trying to get a DHCP address because he just said, I can't get one. And he'd give himself the 169.254 default Windows block or something like that address and be dead in the water. In Nexus land, that's called an edge port. Chris is suggesting here the bridge assurance might make LoopGuard redundant. That's a possibility there. What about UDLD, which isn't spanning tree per se, but UDLD is a unidirectional link detection, very often used on optical links to detect that you've got maybe the send side working, but the receive side is broken. UDLD is a protocol that rides in between adjacent switches and is intended to prove that that link is forwarding in one direction but not the other, and then take it out of forwarding completely before spanning tree decides it's a good idea to put traffic across that link. So again, UDLD isn't spanning tree as such, but I'm curious, are you guys running UDLD in your Nexus environments?
Absolutely.
Yeah, any place I run fiber, I run it.
Are there any major differences in how UDLD is implemented on the Nexus boxes that's worth mentioning?
Just that the command isn't there by default.
Yeah, it's good. It's a feature enablement.
Aha. So like
everything's a feature enablement.
Yeah, so you turn on feature UDLD or whatever the syntax is so that you can get it, and then, just like always, turn it on to knock that port down if, in fact, it's forwarding one direction but not the other.
Usually after cursing about the command not being there.
Yeah.
And just think, if you run UDLD, do you need LACP on the same link?
Well, if you want to form the aggregation, it helps.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, but if you know what I'm saying, though, because UDLD should take the port out if it doesn't see anything.
UDLD will tear it down fast.
Yeah. So as in belt and suspenders approach, you run both.
Now, I'm just curious. There was a debate I had about this many moons ago. Do you run UDLD across a copper link? And I was arguing that I really don't see the point of that because I don't. Just curious if any of you guys had actually done that and think that's a good idea or not.
So copper 10100 and 1000 stuff has link pulses that are there all the time.
Exactly.
And pretty much do that job. I don't see any reason to run it. I can't say for sure on the various 10 gig flavors of copper whether that's there or not.
Yeah, no, I've never seen a point in running UDLD on anything other than optics, but I did get into a, I don't want to say it was a heated argument, but there were some strong opinions that we should run it on every port no matter what. Really? You sure you want to do that? Because that's a lot of overhead on a big switch. Anyway, miscellaneous stuff here. So we're winding down this show on layer 2 stuff. We've got a few other smaller topics to hit. One is, well, we mentioned IGMP snooping a bit earlier on. IGMP snooping being a multicast feature, internet group multicast membership protocol. Oh, it's been a while since that. It's the one that basically says, hi, I'm a host, and I want to participate in this multicast group, and then there's, you know, an announcements and an enrollment process that goes through back and forth. If you've got a switch that does IGMP snooping, the switch looks at that traffic, the IGMP traffic coming from the host, and says, oh, he wants to participate and receive the traffic from sent from this multicast group, so or from this host to this multicast group, so I'm going to include this port, and ports that do not actually have an IGMP request that enrolls them in that multicast group, they don't get it. Meaning, you don't have to flood your multicast traffic to every single port on the switch. You can intelligently flood only to the hosts that have actually requested it. But Chris, you had some comments that you wanted to make about IGMP snooping in a Nexus VPC environment.
Right. So in a VPC environment, so IGMP snooping is turned off by a lot of shops, right? Multicast is hard, but there are multicast applications that want to scream at each other just within a single VLAN. So you don't need, you know, you don't need to run PIM. You don't need a multicast router of any kind. And but in those cases, you do need to switch off IGMP snooping, because if you don't have a system, a router on the a multicast router on the segment asking the question, "Hey, who wants what?" then none of the hosts are going to share that information with the switch, and you'll have traffic delivery problems. So a lot of guys in simple configurations will just turn off IGMP snooping on their multicast VLAN, and the multicast packets flood everywhere, just like they did before IGMP snooping was invented.
Right.
You can't do that on a VPC, and it's for the same reason I outlined earlier about the broadcast, right? If you send a multicast frame into a VPC, so you, and then your, you know, your OS hashes that onto one of your two links, and it hits one of the two VPC domain switches. That switch is going to send it over to his neighbor, who has to make some good decisions about what to do with it. With IGMP snooping turned off, bad decisions get made. In the Nexus environment, leave it running and introduce an IGMP querier. You do that in the VLAN configuration context, way at the top of the config. There's a command, IP IGMP snooping querier or something along those lines, and you throw an IP address in there. Any IP address on your VLAN is fine. It can be the one that you're using as your SVI already, or you can just make one up. It doesn't matter. And the switch will initiate synthetic IGMP queries that keep this IGMP snooping and all the multicast flooding within that VLAN happy. You don't know how to have to do multicast. You just need this one-liner in VLAN context. Do that on two different switches for redundancy, using two different source addresses, and everything will be fine.
Of course, of keen interest for the guys that are running, you know, bigger multicast shops, which, as you said, that's typically... I was going to say special needs. That's typically a very particular requirement where you're running a lot of multicast. I guess I was going to say it's becoming more common. I don't even know if that's true. I mean, Chris, I know a lot of your background was tied up in trading floors, which of course is big multicast.
Yeah, but even some Microsoft Exchange or SharePoint clusters, you know, like to scream and shout at each other with multicast, right? So in a non-routed scenario, there's a lot of shops that. Even your application folks might have turned it on. Nobody realizes it.
Yeah, I'll also throw out, you just reminded me that these F5s that I've been working on this week now can do quite a bit with multicast related to their clustering, which has gone through the roof with what you can do with 11.1 now. A lot more features than what there used to be with the F5 stuff. So one other feature here that's worth mentioning, in some regards, the elephant in the room would be FabricPath, or FabricPath is Cisco's version of Trill. Trill being roughly positioned as the ultimate replacement for a spanning tree, in that you can do layer 2 multipathing in a loop-free way. Trill introduces the concept of an R-bridge, and R-bridges talk to each other in a topology where MAC addresses that are known to each R-bridge are advertised to the other ones across a redundant setup of links. And then an algorithm is used, like a routing algorithm, to determine what is the shortest destination from me to that MAC address I'm trying to get to. When that is determined, the frame is encapsulated into a trill frame, forwarded from one R bridge to another R bridge, and ultimately delivered to its destination. Now, trill was just very recently standardized, and it's not that Cisco's doing proprietary trill because they're big and mighty Cisco and they'll do whatever the heck they want, but because, I mean, trill literally just within early 2012 came to a point where it is finally standardized. So Brocade VCS is doing trill, and again, it's their own bit of proprietary way of doing it, and Cisco's doing trill with FabricPath, and again, their own kind of special way of doing it. So getting into how to architect FabricPath and Trill is really beyond the scope of this show. It's not what most people are doing. It is a license add feature, and it was rather pricey when I looked at it. I just looked at it for fun to know how much it was. It was a pretty significant license cost, and I think you guys have run into the same thing where you have said, yeah, FabricPath was costly enough that it was prohibitive to actually add it in. Would you agree with that?
I guess it depends on the use case, but I know there's a license charge, and it'll probably come down to the ultimate design of a topology that you need to do. Does it make sense to do it? I mean, if you're running a boatload of 10 gig, 7K, 5Ks, it may make sense to have that versus some of the other stuff. Probably come down to a design and budget question.
Yeah, I mean, if you think of FabricPath as I can route at layer 2, if you kind of think of it that way, that's really what it is, and like Jeff was just saying, there's a use case there that can drive that, depending on how you want to build out your top of rack. If you're not going to build what you would call a fat tree design, where you've got links that then collapse into another layer with bigger links that then collapse into a core level layer with even bigger links, and you go to something like a leaf spine architecture, Google that, leaf spine architecture, you'll hit Brad Hedlund's article and some other articles that describe some of the newer data center design paradigms that are built around leaf and spine. Trill is a good player, a good match to arbitrate what links are going to get used for which traffic and how they're going to be sent around, and also recover from failures and this kind of thing. If you're doing traditional fat tree, does Trill play in? Not really. You'd have to mesh it out and really do your links somewhat differently for it to make sense. Again, going back to Cisco with FabricPath on the Nexus, there's a play here where Cisco has really put their stake in the ground behind Trill, because there's a competing technology called SPB, Shortest Path Bridging, also just ratified this year, that's got some other muscle behind it. Alcatel-Lucent, Avaya, and Huawei are really on the SPB bandwagon. So, I mean, Greg and I were talking about this a bit on an earlier show that you might have caught. And, Greg's theory, which I kind of agree with, is it's looking like shortest path bridging is probably going to be targeted more towards the service providers, and Trill is going to be targeted more towards the enterprise, if you kind of look at who's making the play and where. So 2012 is going to be an interesting year as we see who really comes to the fore here with this. And I think if Cisco really wants to see wide fabric path adoption, they're going to end up reducing or dropping the fabric path cost, or changing the cost structure such that you can get fabric path for very little cost. Either they're going to drop the cost of the base switch, and then the additional license cost for fabric path won't hurt your feelings so much. And then we'll see if adoption begins to take off. Now, another thing to keep in the back of your mind, if you're wondering, well, when am I going to see it in my Catalyst 3750? Well, you're not going to see fabric path in your Catalyst 3750 or any of your legacy equipment, because it takes different silicon to forward Trill. You can't do it with the ASICs that are in those older switches. So that's a bit of a showstopper, but it is a technology, therefore, to be looking towards if you are deploying Nexus, because it's baked into the 7Ks and the 5Ks, all the tools right there.
It's in the F1 and F2 line cards for the 7K, if I remember correctly. Not the M cards. I think it's only the F1 and F2s.
Okay, sure. But again, yeah, it even underscores that point about the hardware even more than if it's not available on every line card in the 7K, then you want FabricPath, and you got to look even more carefully at what you're buying for line cards to make sure if FabricPath is important to you, to make sure that the line cards can even do it. So that's going to be an interesting play, and that's one of those, it's a developing story. Stay tuned. Not many people are running it, but know that your Nexus boxes can do it while your Catalyst boxes can't, and see where that ends up. All right. Is there anything else that we wanted to cover in this show, gentlemen?
I think we did it.
Chirp, chirp. Okay. So for those of you that are following this series with some interest, this is part two of the series. Part three, the next show, we are targeting coverage of Fexes. The next plan here is Fexes. It's a good follow-up to this this conversation. Fex being the fabric extender, that's the next, typically the 2K line. And there's a bunch of design considerations for Fex, and that'll be the next discussion that we have with this group. So, guys, thank you all for joining Packet Pushers today to talk about your Nexus and Virtual Port Channel experiences. And, Tony, what are you going to be working on this week?
This week I've got a bunch of vendors coming in. Actually going to be focusing mostly on ISE.
ISE as in Identity Services Engine?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so you got a BYOD deployment going on, or...?
Not BYOD, actually just freshly rolling out wireless to our entire office. So
cool. And now you're pretty active in social media. How can people follow you on Twitter and where you're blogging and so on?
You can find me at T-O-N-H-E, or you can find my blog at routerjockey.com.
And Jeff, same question to you. What big, cool, awesome thing are you going to be working on this week, and how can people follow you on the interwebs?
This week I will be working on turning up a DC in Hong Kong to the internet, so I have some ASR 9000 configs to work with the vendor. Letting my knee recover so I don't get yelled at by the doctor for overdoing it still. I got told I was overdoing it yesterday. And if you want to find me on Twitter, I'm at fryguy_PA, and I blog at fryguy.net.
And Chris.
Yes. This week... I'll be doing a lot of studying on fiber channel switches. I don't know anything about them, and trying to fix that. And I'm on the Twitter also. I'm at Chris Marquette, and I have a blog at fragmentationneeded.net.
I'm Ethan Banks, at EC Banks on Twitter, and you can follow me at packetpushers.net. That is where I blog. And hey, thank you for listening to the show this week. You can follow the Packet Pushers if you just want to follow the show. Greg Farrow and I both use the at Packet Pushers account. And of course, if you go up to packetpushers.net, that's the hub, that's home base for the show. That's where the blogs are. We're putting new content out every week. And of course, the podcasts are there and the RSS feeds and links over to iTunes and so on. All of that is at packetpushers.net. Please visit and email your comments or questions if you have anything for us at this show to packetpushers@gmail.com. If you got something specific for me or Tony, Jeff, or Chris, if you just send it to packetpushers@gmail.com, I will make sure that one of those guys get it if necessary. And, of course, remember that too much networking would never be enough.